This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm Fiona, and I'm here with Fiona. And joining us in the studio today, we have a world exclusive. We have the real Fiona Healy. So, hello, Fiona. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Fiona.
Excellent, Fiona. Right, so it's absolutely fantastic to have you back here on the show, because some of our regular listeners may recognise Fiona as the Fiona Healy. How are you? What are you doing with yourself now that you've left the Jodcast behind?
Right, well, I'm very good, thanks. And I got to say, it's really weird to be on this side of the microphone. I should say for our listeners, I'm actually not directly in front of the microphone. I am Skyping with the microphone, in fact.
You're about 270 kilometres behind the microphone?
Yeah, about that. Yeah. But Fiona and Fiona have very kindly, to make me feel comfortable and at home in the studio, have placed the computer exactly where I would be sitting if I was actually in the studio, on the other side of the microphone. So
I assure you it was mostly for our convenience and not yours.
Yeah, well, that also makes sense.
Yeah.
If you were familiar with the layout of the Jodcast studio, you'd understand why. But anyway, yeah, no, I'm very well, thanks, although I'm a little bit tired because I've just come home from work, and I'm in London now, and I'm working in a real job.
What's one of those?
So my job, so what I'm doing now is I'm working for the civil service, and I'm actually working in a slightly ironic twist, given my nationality, I'm working in the Department for Exiting the European Union.
Oh, okay. So how much are you actually allowed to tell us? Is there a plan?
I mean, basically nothing. I can tell you that I was hired because background of astrophysics was surprisingly relevant to the civil service.
Oh, really? How?
Well, because a lot of what I did was data visualization, which though applied to Radio Novae, actually can be applied to anything. So yeah, so although I haven't been doing much of that yet, I've only been working there for about a week.
Fair enough. So I suppose we should actually, as an attempt at some sort of astrophysics podcast, we probably should ask you a little bit of astrophysics. So you've always been on the same side of the mic as we have. So it's time now to tell us about what you actually do. So while you were here at
Novae... Well, I've alluded to it over the years, although I never really liked discussing it when I was doing it, because, you know. But now that it's over and in the past, I can talk about it. So, I recently had my viva. Well, not recently anymore, it was before Christmas now. I had my viva and became a doctor of radio astronomy. And my thesis title, goodness now, what was it now? Radio Observations and Modeling of Classical Nova Explosions. That was what my thesis was about. And so what it was a nova. God, I don't know, I'm sure I've talked about what a nova is before on the show, but actually a lot of people, and even a lot of astronomers, don't know what a nova is. And
what's
people are like,
what's between a nova and a supernova?
Yeah, you know, one knows. They're actually not the same at all. Before when telescopes were kind of, and people didn't really know what they were doing, they would see these big flashy explodey things, and they were all called novas.
Is that the technical term? I hope it is.
Yeah, it is. Well, that was the technical term until they decided to call them novas, because it's like a new star, a nova. That became the technical term. They were all called novas. Anything that was really bright and not always there was called a nova. But then when telescopes kind of got a bit better, and specifically when astronomers developed the capacity to determine with a bit of accuracy how far away things were, they discovered that even though lots of things looked bright and flashy, some were so far away that they'd have to be really, really bright in order to even be seen. So they realized that of all the bright, flashy things they were looking at, some of them just had to be so much brighter than the others. So those became known as supernovae. Super bright, flashy things. And the rest were just called novae. And so now we understand. So then, like, they didn't know. Like, they knew what a supernova was, but they didn't know what the other things were at all. They were like, okay, well, we know what these really bright ones are, but this... And they'd worked out, you know, what a supernova was about, which is, you know, the death of a star, and it explodes and it becomes a black hole and whatever. Boring. But boring compared to novae, in my opinion. So now they know that novae are actually something entirely different to that. So while a supernova is the death of a star, a nova is actually kind of business as usual for the star. So it's when a star kind of has a little explosion and then just goes back to normal.
Sort of like a flare?
Yeah, well, I suppose we're kind of at the really boring categorization part of the conversation here. So there's a whole bunch of things called cataclysmic variables, which are basically all these leftover bright flashy things that aren't supernovae. And in fact, I think supernovae are cataclysmic variables too, actually.
I thought a cataclysmic variable was anything that changed was a result of something cataclysmic. Mm, okay.
Supernovae wouldn't be recurrent, obviously.
No.
No, and even novae aren't always recurrent, although sometimes they are.
It seems so wonderfully vague.
Well, that may be partly because my brain is totally fried after an 11-hour day in the office.
It's fine for you, honey. It's like...
We can go with it.
Yeah.
I feel like I've done my Viva and I've deleted all this information.
we'll come on to that, actually. Yeah. Like, anyway, but...
So is this what we have to look forward to, Fiona and me?
Yeah, this is what your brain is going to turn into when you're done. It's going to just all turn into mush. It's terrible. So anyway, a nova, it's a star in a binary system. So I'll just talk about specifically what they are. So it's a star in a binary system, and the binary system goes round and round and round, and one star accretes material from the other star and hoovers it all up. And essentially what happens is the accreted material forms a layer on top of the accreting star. So it forms this nice layer on the surface, and the more stuff gets dumped on there, the denser. Now I've got to be careful because there's all this weird stuff with degeneracy. It's boring to think about why the layer is degenerate, but it is. So the accreted material, it's degenerate gas. And the reason that's important is because it kind of gets hotter and hotter and hotter, but because of the way degenerate material behaves, the increase in temperature doesn't... So you know with a regular gas, increasing the temperature causes it to expand. But with a degenerate gas, that's not the case because there's no dependency on temperature in the equation of state. So you can heat it up, you can make it really, really hot, and essentially it'll just kind of sit there, and it'll just keep sitting there, and eventually it gets hot enough that nuclear reactions can start happening inside it. So there's kind of like a flash point where it becomes really, really hot, and at some point on the surface, a nuclear explosion takes place, and that, in the waves of nuclear reactions, triggers a whole bunch of other nuclear reactions until the whole thing, the whole layer, is basically this kind of exploding nuclear nightmare layer.
Really cool.
Is it
at the center of the star you've got fusion. Is it like that but on the surface?
I should have cleared that up. It's a white dwarf.
Oh, it's a white dwarf.
Yeah, so it's not doing much. But you have this crazy layer surrounding it that's like exploding. And it can do that for a while. Well, when I say a while, I mean a few seconds. Because the degenerate gas, like I was saying, it can get hotter and hotter and hotter and not really change its volume. Because with the non-degenerate gas, obviously, once it got a little bit hotter, it would expand and cool. But that's not happening here. So it's just these perfect conditions for it to get really, really hot. But with degenerate gas, there's this kind of tipping point called the Fermi temperature, which is connected to the Fermi energy. And I understood this very, very well on the day of my Viva, but I've now forgotten it. It's the sort of thing where any time I've needed to understand it, I've been able to like prepare it in my short-term memory, and then it goes away.
And then post-Viva drinks happened and it left forever.
Yeah.
Never to be seen again.
Exactly. So anyway, there is this tipping point. It gets so hot, basically, that it stops being like a degenerate gas and starts being more like a regular ideal gas. And at that point, its equation of state does depend on temperature again. So suddenly you've got this really, really, really hot layer of gas. And it's like, oh no, oh God, I'm very hot. I have to be the volume that corresponds to this heat. So it just expands really, really fast. Or it explodes, to use the colloquialism. So it basically explodes out into the interstellar medium. And that's a nova explosion. So all this stuff gets ejected off the surface of the star. And this doesn't really interfere with the binary in any way. The binary keeps on orbiting. It doesn't destroy the white dwarf. Like, as far as the binary system is concerned, things are pretty much business as usual, except for this big explosion, which has just happened. My PhD was specifically concerned with the stuff that gets ejected into the interstellar medium, because for years, for a long, long time, people who studied novae, and these have been around for a while. I mean, when I was doing my lit review, I was reading up on them, and earliest records kind of... it's hard to say, because for a while they kind of didn't know what they were looking at, and then there was somewhere like retroactively they kind of thought, oh yeah, that was probably a Nova. But some of the earliest references were from like the early 1900s. And in fact, I was very pleased to see, so one of the references that I was chasing up, it was from like 1903 or something. And it was like Clark et al. 1903. It was a book actually by this Clark. And I was like, oh, who's this person? And I discovered Clark was a woman, Agnes Clark. Not only was she a woman, she was an Irish woman. Not only was she an Irish woman, she was from Cork, which is where I'm from. So yeah. I was like, oh,
there we go.
So 110 years later, here I am in Manchester. So what was that, Josh?
I was just thinking the circle of life.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, but for a long time, I mean, when she was looking at them now, they really didn't know. Like, they didn't even know they were binary systems. They were looking at the spectra going, it's very strange. One bit of it seems to be coming towards us. The other bit seems to be going away. What could possibly be happening?
No one saw that and went, rotation?
It took them a while. It just took a while.
Okay.
Well, I suppose it seems obvious to us now with the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah, hindsight is 20/20.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, for a long time, they said, okay, this stuff just gets ejected out, and in the way of scientists, they said, oh, and it's probably a sphere. It probably takes the form of a sphere, because sure, why wouldn't it? But, like, pretty much every single resolved image of these shows an ejecta, which is not spherical, like, at all. And there's like a lot of other indications that the stuff that comes off them isn't spherical. And when you really think about it, why would it be? Because it's being ejected out. There's this binary system there which has the potential to kind of transfer all kinds of things into stuff. And I'll give you the technical term in a second.
No, it's fine. I like the lay terms that we're getting here. So this is
I swear, this is what it was like in my private. It was terrible.
But you passed. You are Dr. Fiona Healy.
I know, exactly. It's because I never really worked in a group. I always worked alone. And I think it's like, you know, babies, you know, if you don't talk to babies, they never develop a vocabulary, and they like, you know, it's hard for them to like learn English and have literacy because they haven't been spoken to, and that's how babies learn. People speak to them. That's what I was like, because I worked alone for most of my PhD. There was no group. It was just me. It's like, I know what I'm doing. I just don't have the words because I wasn't really used to talking about it. But it was nice working alone too. I kind of got to do my own thing. But anyway.
A few of my undergraduate lecturers suddenly make more sense now.
Yes.
Yeah, no, really. You spend too long alone and you just forget how to speak English. So basically, the stuff that comes off the Nova, the ejected, the hot layer of gas that gets blown out in space, for a very long time now, people have been thinking, oh, it's not spherical. And we had some observations made with E. Merlin, which you guys all know, some of you have been there, of this Nova called V959 Mon, or Nova Mon 2012. Bit cashier. We had like, I think 6 or 7 observations. I presented 6 in my thesis because the 7th was kind of me. And I mean, they were all a bit kind of me, to be honest.
There were varying levels of it. Yeah.
Yeah. We had these 6 observations of this Nova, like over the course of its evolution, which is a really cool thing to have. I mean, because of the nature of them, because they like erupt, and then so in the optical they are really hard to observe, like we miss a lot of them because they just flare up and then tail off quite quickly. In the radio they develop over kind of longer time scales because it's thermal bremsstrahlung, so it's optically thick for a while, but then as it expands, I always think of it as a bit like blowing up a balloon. You know, when you blow up a balloon, when you start blowing it up, it's not see-through, but then by the time you get to the end of it, it's see-through. Just like that.
That's a fantastic analogy that I'm definitely going to steal.
Yeah,
no, it's helpful, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's how I always thought of it, because that's pretty much exactly what happens, is the cloud of ejecta expands, it just comes see-through, because the more spread out it is. So yeah, so basically that means in the radio, whereas in the optical they just flare up and then tail off quite fast, in the radio it's a more slow development, so they're a bit easier to observe. They're often kind of far away and kind of dim and a bit poorly resolved. This one was quite near. It's 1.5 kiloparsecs away. I think it reached a peak brightness of about 27 millijanskis in the C band, which is 5 gigahertz. And it was very well resolved. So we were really lucky. It was, it had been observed by the VLA, which doesn't resolve as well because it doesn't have the long baselines. But E. Merlin has these nice long baselines. So we were able to do what we thought was a pretty good job of resolving the structure. And we saw an ejecta that was definitely not a sphere. It was kind of, So first it was a bit like a sphere, the earliest epoch. So epoch is the fancy astronomy word for time, for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with that particular little piece of jargon. So first it was kind of roughly spherical shaped, but then as time progressed, it started becoming more and more sort of, I don't even want to say egg-shaped, it was sort of elongated in the east-west direction. It was sort of, there was kind of two little clumps, and it got more and more elongated in the east-west direction as time went on, until then, so that was like the first four epochs that was doing that. But then for the last two, pretty much all the east-west stuff was gone, and in its place was a north-south elongation. So it completely switched its orientation. Like over the space of, let me see, we had one February 2013, and then by October 2013, it had completely switched from being elongated in the east-west direction to being elongated in the north-south direction.
So is that from like an ejection or explosion, or was it just straight up shape change?
Well, we just didn't know. And we'll get to this later, that was assuming that we believed what we were seeing. But there was kind of evidence, other observations with other instruments and made in different ways kind of backed that up. And in fact, ours wasn't even the first indication that it went through this change in its shape. There was kind of other, the VLA observations kind of hinted at it too. Because otherwise you would just be like, that's really weird. You know, why would it do that? But there was pretty solid evidence, you know, in addition to the Merlin observations to suggest that, yeah, that's what it's doing. So that was really weird. And then before the E-Merlin observations were even finished, like I said, they'd been kind of noticing similar stuff with the VLA. So this crowd over at the VLA, in particular this lady called Laura Chamiok, who I'd love to meet. So I spent my whole PhD reading her paper and, you know, probing her hypothesis and thinking an awful lot about some of the things that she said. and I've never once met her.
Laura, if you're listening, then get in touch.
Yeah, Laura, if you're listening,
right,
you've got
into the PhD show.
But what she said might be happening. So remember I said there's a binary system. She said that the binary system could be interacting with the ejecta. So basically, if you think of the orbital plane of the binary as being a bit like a food processor, so it's going around, the binary system is going around and around and around. And you know, in the food processor, it kind of sweeps things up into sort of a torus shape. She said that's possibly what's going on in the orbital plane. So you get this kind of toroidal component forming in the orbital plane because of interaction with the orbiting binary. And she said that would be quite thick and dense and comparatively slow moving. So the whole time, stuff is getting blown off the surface of the white dwarf. Some of it is essentially getting kind of caught up in the orbital plane of the binary. And so that slow-moving, dense bit in the orbital plane impedes the stuff that's coming off the surface. So what you would see initially is the fast-moving stuff coming off the surface, which is freer to move out along the poles. So basically, where there's no slow, dense stuff, the fast-moving stuff can propagate outwards at great speed, and that would be kind of, yeah, along the polar axis of the white dwarf. That's what you'd see first, and it would be kind of aspherical, obviously. And then that would fade away because it would become oxycletin, so it would, like the balloon, it would disappear. And then what would remain is the slower stuff that got swept up in the orbital plane. That would basically still be optically thick at that point because it's slower moving. And so once the faster component fades away, you'd see the slower component. And whether or not the kind of mechanics of that are spot on or not, I don't know. But basically, it does kind of make sense that if you had two components moving at different speeds, that would cause the shift from being elongated in one direction to being elongated in the other. This is so much easier. This is very hard to explain on the radio because you really need to draw diagrams.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that. The mimes are helping us, but
yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame that those won't be visible to the listeners. But you know,
we've been ASCII art on the
yeah.
Podcast, anyway.
Perhaps we should invest in a Fiona Show whiteboard.
Yes.
You know what you should have is some Fiona Show emojis. And you could have one of me like going like this and another of me going like this.
some little bitmoji of you.
Yeah. But anyway, all of that is kind of getting very bogged down in detail. But basically, suffice it to say, instead of being a sphere, it is thought that perhaps the ejecta has two components. One is slow and one is fast. You see the fast one first, then it becomes optically thin and you see the slow one. And so that is how you could have those kinds of changes that that dramatic change in the orientation of the ejecta. So basically, I spent a lot of time staring at those pictures and thinking about that and making various little measurements and estimations of their expansion velocity and fitting models to the light curve. But then we were a bit worried because we were like, A, is it even possible for that kind of mechanic of a slow component and a fast component to produce that kind of... Would that lead to what we saw with E. Merlin? Would a slow component and a fast component give rise to the kind of ejecta that we saw with E. Merlin? Was the first question that we wanted to look into. And secondly, we were a little concerned because E. Merlin has, depending on the kind of source you're observing, its UV coverage isn't always complete. And now I'm definitely not going to get into this with a whiteboard.
That's fine.
But basically, a radio telescope doesn't ever really get a complete picture of the sky. It kind of traces out lines, and you've got to fit a picture to those. You get the bits that you can actually see, and you've got to, in a very simplified way, got to say, right, what fits that? You know, you have to kind of, to an extent, replicate what's in those gaps that you can't see.
It's sort of dot to dot, isn't it?
Boy. It is a bit like join the dots, except with Fourier transforms.
Yeah.
That's
so, inverted Fourier transform dot to dot. That's
yeah.
I grew up on those. It's they were my staple train puzzle.
Exactly. I mean, like all children.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you're sitting there thinking to yourselves, "Oh God, those scientists—they're just making things up." That's not quite true. We make a very educated guess, and there's kind of ways of knowing if that guess is wrong, and especially radio astronomy. It's a funny one. It's like you almost have to, like, you have to start learning how to do it when you're quite young, I always think, and just develop sort of instincts around it. So, you know, there comes a point where you can be like, I don't think that bit's real, and but yes, this is real, and, you know, you just, it's a delicate art.
Having gone a course in radio astronomy, I completely appreciate that, because I don't understand it at all. Interferometry is just a dark art, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean... Yeah, I recall, what was it Cullum said? He was at a conference once, and he was sitting behind two kind of older scientists, and they were looking at some images, and one said to the other, you know, do you believe these? And the other said, yeah, you know, I do. And the first one said, oh, do you really believe them, though? And the second one said, well, I wouldn't be too comfortable if there were an MRI scan of my brain. You know, it's like, yeah, we believe them because... The stakes aren't too high if they're actually wrong, but, you know, it's probably for the best that, say, for things like medical imaging, they have more refined techniques. But yeah, so all of which is to say, we don't make things up at all, but it is a bit of a subtle science figuring out what is in those bits that you can't see. So anyway, we'd seen this weird ejecta, but we were like, are we really sure that's actually what's there? Could it not be a sphere that's just been a bit distorted because we haven't seen the whole thing? And you can kind of, like, you can imagine that this isn't quite how it works because of the Fourier transforms, which would just make everything a bit more complicated. But basically, you can imagine if you were kind of looking at something spherical, but you could only see, like, through a little slit, you'd think it was quite a different shape. It's a bit like that. So we had a concern that maybe the observations we made with E. Merlin could have been the result of just distortion of a perfectly normal spherical shell of ejecta. So those are the two options. Either there's kind of a very complex, you know, two components thing causing this switch in elongation, or it's just a regular old sphere that's expanding out and appearing to be different wobbly shapes as it expands through this kind of patchy UV coverage. So to check which of those two things, if either was the case, I did a whole bunch of simulations, which are still weighing my computer down.
Are they still going, then?
They're not still going, thanks be to God, but all the data they've spit out is still sitting on here. I have a tiny amount of space left on my hard drive. So I made up a pretend nova with some pretend ejecta and simulated what that would look like at radio frequencies. And then, now, and I didn't write all these scripts myself, so Tim wrote the script, my supervisor, Tim O'Brien, you guys know, the listeners don't know. Yeah. He had a code that would simulate the radio emission, and then there's this other code which Adam Avison has adapted from the ALMA observation support tool, and you guys know Adam. Adam's written this, well, adapted this, done a really neat job of adapting. That sounds so condescending. I mean,
well,
Adam.
Done, Adam.
Good job, Adam. No, Adam has this amazing, eMerlin observation support tool, which he adapted from the ALMA observation support tool, which basically it looks at your simulated ejecta and simulates what that would look like to eMerlin. So basically what I was able to do is explore the two possibilities that we were considering. Either it's a sphere or it's two components. I made those ejectas and fed them into the eMerlin observation support tool and looked at the results. And I had to do that a load of different times, especially for the two components, because we were like, we don't know how fast they are. We don't know what the ratio of their masses is. I had this big parameter space. So I did a load of simulations and kind of studied all the output of all of those to find ones which I thought kind of matched up well enough. I was basically looking for something which was, you had two components and I wanted one to be bright at the start and then the other to be bright at the end, because that'd be one dominating at the start and the other dominating at the end. So that took a very long time, and then when that was done, I came to the conclusion that the two-component model could have caused something a bit like what we saw, kind of not bright enough. So it's a plausible model for sure, but there's something going on there that we haven't taken into account, which is the entirely logical conclusion, because it's a pretty simplistic model. The spherical one, unfortunately, when I ran the spherical model, it replicated eerily well the north-south elongation that we saw.
Oh dear.
But it didn't replicate the east-west stuff at all. So basically neither of them explain what we saw, but the two-component model is probably a bit closer than the spherical model. And that was my very sort of gentle conclusion.
Huh. Sounds like there's another PhD project in that.
Yeah, do you want to come back and do that?
Yes, I would love to. No. I'm done with this now. I'm sorry, that must have been a bit boring for you guys and for all our listeners. You feel free to cut it as much as you want.
Okay, so something that I actually wanted to ask you was, when we're interviewing people, we're always interviewing people who are still within the science world.
That are active academics.
Yeah, they're still part of the community. And obviously, you are welcome to come and visit the community. But what I kind of wanted to ask was, why did you leave? Why have you left us, Fiona?
I mean, there are a bunch of reasons. I suppose I felt ready for a bit of a change of pace. You know, I feel like I've been a student for nearly 10 years. I've been a radio astronomer for, goodness, technically maybe six or seven years. I've been in that kind of academic bubble all my adult life. I wanted to try something different. I wanted to work on a team. That's always something that I get. That's something I got to do when I worked in the Jodcast, and I liked it. So I thought, yeah.
We liked
so. Yeah. Yeah. So that was part of it. Just really a change. I just thought, you know, academia is very competitive. It's not easy, especially if you're in a relationship. So my boyfriend and I were both radio astronomers. Neither of us are now. And so he did a postdoc while I was doing my PhD. It's very, very hard. Very hard, especially if there's two of you. But even if there's only one of you, you know, especially in your early career, you move around a lot. There's no job stability. The pay is not so good. You're expected to kind of just do it for the love of it. But I love shopping and modern art and Prosecco. my job is kind of just what I do during the day, and it's always been that way for me. I'm not vocational. So yeah, no, I just thought, not for me. And so I went into the civil service, because it's quite the opposite of that. I've known for its, well, that's not why I went into the civil service, but it is a perk, it's a much different kind of environment to academia. Although, and I'm not sure if this is the case in the UK, in Ireland, academics, postdocs, lecturers are technically civil servants. So, but I don't think that's the case in the UK, is it?
I've never heard of anything like that.
No. Yeah, in Ireland they're on the civil service conveyor belt. That's how their salary works. Maybe not all of them, but certainly lots of them. This is all very vague and rambly, but yeah, basically I just wanted to change and I wanted to kind of feel useful, which isn't to say that doing research isn't useful, because it absolutely is. I wouldn't even say I didn't feel like I was particularly useful at it, because I was.
I mean, you passed. So
yeah,
you must
exactly,
have been.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I guess, yeah, no, just a change of pace. And yeah, myself and my boyfriend can live in the same place now because we've both left academia, so we're free to choose where we go. So that was a big part of it. Yeah, and I'm excited to be where I am now. You know, I've only been in my new job a week. I'm a bit tired and I'm still very much feeling my way. And I'm getting to use a lot of my skills. So that's the other thing I'll say is that, you know, when you do a PhD, it really trains you for a lot of unexpected things. And it gives you a lot of transferable skills that I think PhD students don't always realize they have. We're not taught to think that way. We're not taught to think about what we're doing in, you know, in any other way except with respect to research outcomes sometimes. I mean, and that never came from Tim or any person who supervised me or, you know, that I interacted with, but it's just, it's kind of the way the field works. You know, you publish papers and you get results and the slog you have to go through to get to those things. So it, you know, it teaches you really valuable things, but isn't always valued, even though, you know, next time you have to solve a similar problem, it's never as hard because of all the things you learned when you were solving the previous problem. And, you know, even things like public speaking, you know, and attending conferences, being good at that, right? What does that even mean, being good at it? But having experience at it, having put yourself in that situation and having done it is a really useful thing to have done that lots of people don't get the opportunity to do. So basically what I'm saying is having a PhD is really useful. And I'm finding now that I'm in this situation where I really feel I can apply some of the skills that, even though I'm not doing any astronomy, I feel like I'm definitely using what I've learned in Manchester. So that's nice. And I'm learning lots of new stuff too, though. Lots of acronyms. It's all about the acronyms in civil service, even more so than astronomy.
Astronomy is pretty notorious for acronyms.
Yes. Are they contrived?
Pardon?
Are they as contrived as
No. I mean, these guys are just out of control. Like, sometimes you'll have a conversation where it's like a good 30% of it is acronyms. So, yeah.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic answer. Jake, have you got anything?
Well, I suppose the one big area that we haven't covered yet is your involvement with the Jodcast over the years, and of course, the genesis of this, the Fiona Show.
The Fiona Show. Well, yeah, I guess, you know, I was inspired to have the Fiona Show by the tremendous fun that I had on the Jodcast. I thought, you know, every time I was doing an episode, I was like, you know what would be great if this was actually just the Fiona Show.
What about me?
I'm sure the presenters and the listeners all agree with me. Because I love presenting so much. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. No, I remember, like, there would be times when, you know, I would typically, if it was early on in the day and I'd have a lot of energy and I'd be like, yeah, presenting, great. And I'd go into it, you know, going home. And then there'd be times where I'd be like, oh, no, I'm too tired and I hate my thesis and I hate my life. But then I would do the presenting and it would, like, cheer me up so much. That's why I never want to stop presenting, which is why the Fiona Show was born.
Excellent. So have you got any particular favourite memories from working on the broadcast?
So a broadcastable favourite memory, one of my favourite memories is very possibly the time I interviewed Jocelyn Bell Burnell. That was, well, favourite / most exciting / most terrifying. That was scary. She's a formidable woman. She kind of reminded me of my secondary school physics teacher. I had this feeling throughout the whole interview that I hadn't done my homework and I was really scared. And I was hoping she wouldn't find out. But no, it was really nice to meet her and talk to her. And I liked the live show. That was fun. Were you guys there for the live show?
That was before our time, unfortunately.
Oh, the live show.
We're going to try and do another one.
Oh, see, this is good. This is why it's good that we've got, like, a constant rollover. It's why it's good we've got a constant rollover of presenters and producers, because you guys don't remember what it was like to organize. So, yeah, I know it was loads of fun to organize. And
I just had a really panicked look off Jake when I mentioned that.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, the live show was brilliant. Jocelyn Bell Burnell was brilliant. God, it just, I remember my first Jodcast and it was Christina Smith, whose birthday it is today, actually. Happy birthday, Christina, if you're listening, although it won't be her birthday at the time of airing, but it is her birthday at the time of recording.
Happy birthday to Christina, and yeah, also to anyone that is listening at this time of recording
from
some
point
listening
in the past.
Yeah, but it was Christina Smith who wrote me into the Jodcast. I remember she came into, she was doing her PhD and she was in the same office as me, and she came in and she said, we're one presenter short with the Jodcast, we need someone to come and do it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And there I was with my odd and end all written out on a piece of paper with paragraphs and everything.
I'm slowly edging away from that level of preparation.
Oh, yeah, no, I tailed off very fast. And I mean, like, even the days when I used to come in with it written on my arm, like towards the end, I would not even write anything down at all and just talk about some random thoughts I had about an Ars Technica article I read that day. So you guys will get there. So it's a good place.
Oh, yeah. Adam is still 3 or 4 months on. Has a go at me, primarily, for your odd and end that descended into me sketching.
So what I feel like we should have done, you know what we should have done is we should have just opened it up as a listener competition. We should have just described it and said, guys, send your picture then.
Yeah, but see, this is the thing. Adam completely cut the segment. Like that whole bit went, which was
shame. That was some quality radio.
Quality radio that I'm sure will make it into some sort of blooper reel at the point.
I've got the raw audio stored locally on this machine that we're doing the recording on. It is phenomenal.
You can add it to the long list of my bloopers. There's many of them. But yeah, no, I used to we used to have more rigid kind of structure before, obviously, where you would have like a lead presenter and two kind of, you know,
backing down.
Million presenters. Yeah.
Well, nominally that structure is still there, but it is pretty flexible.
Yeah, no, it's changed a lot over the time that I've been on it. A shout out to Hannah Stacey, if she's listening. She and I recorded some good podcasts together. It was great. Including one where we had one comment from a listener saying, good show, shame about the women giggling throughout.
Well, that commenter is in for a rough show.
Yeah. Yep. It did not take the wind out of my sails in the least, as you can see.
It fuels you more.
Yeah, no, really. I was a reformed character. I never giggled again.
You can't even say that with a great face, can you?
Yeah, no, I couldn't.
I've run out of planned questions. So, do you have any... Have you got any ideas of where the Fiona Show or the Jodcast should go
good question.
In the future? Have you got anything that you always wanted to see happen that never got realised that we can now take and run?
Well, I can tell you the next thing that's probably going to happen on the Fiona Show is a gin and tonic, but on the Jodcast, what would I like to see happen? That's a really good question, because I feel like over the years there have been things I've wanted to do. I mean, I guess what I always wanted to do on the Jodcast and what I always kind of tried to do was, I know people listen, for the science and to hear about science, which is great, but I always wanted to perpetuate the idea that scientists are humans. Scientists are people. I think there can be this really, you know, it's a nice idea, but a bit of a romanticized idea, I think, of what a scientist is and what they do every day. And I always, in my appearances on the Jodcast, try to kind of, I guess, just send home the idea that, you know, we're people and we have human thoughts and emotions and feelings, and, you know, sometimes doing research is hard, not because the research is hard, but because being a human is hard. So I guess what I love about the Jodcast and what I hope will keep happening is that it's a show about science, but, you know, given by, you know, real human scientists, and that human element is a real part of it. So I think that's really important. I mean, not just because, you know, we're people too and scientists have feelings and blah, blah, blah. But because actually science itself can never be free from the fact that humans are doing it. And I think there's a real tendency to kind of ignore that or try and stamp it out or try and think, no, but science is impartial or science is, you know, almost divine. It's not. Science is done by humans and is both limited and inspired by that. The human element of science, I think, is more important than people give it credit for. And that should be a thing that people hear when they listen to the podcast, that scientists are humans. So yeah, every single answer I've given you has been this kind of rambling stream of consciousness.
I mean, rambling streams of consciousness that are worth listening to.
Okay, well, I'm just...
Agreed.
I need my gin and tonic. It's been a long day.
Okay, on that note then, should we perhaps wrap up?
Yeah, well, it was really, really nice talking to you guys, and I miss you, and I hope that, you know, the Jodcast continues to go from strength to strength, and I wish I could be there still sometimes.
Well, we'll keep in touch, and maybe you will actually be able to be back in this studio at one point.
Yeah,
I love that.
You are welcome back once you've had your G&T.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I'll be around for my graduation. Maybe you guys can get an interview with me in my funny hat and my big cream egg robes.
Yeah, of course.
That can work.
Right.
Yeah. So, well, anyway.
Yes, Fiona, thank you very much for your time. And now, I've always wanted to say this, and now back to you in the studio.